Apparently, losing $6.7 billion in just 6 months is all Lehman Brothers can take. The investment bank is now looking for a buyer after losing bets in the mortgage market. A deal could be announced as early as this weekend. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve are working with Lehman Brothers to find potential buyers, including Bank of America. NPR's Jim Zeroli is covering this story from New York. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
How did Lehman Brothers get to this point?
Oh, it's an all too familiar story. It lost a lot of money in the subprime mortgage crisis, you know, getting involved with these really complex mortgage-backed securities. A lot of critics also say it just waited too long to address the problems. People lost confidence in the company. Its stock price fell. Then on Wednesday, the company announced a plan to try to shore up its finances. It said it was going to sell its investment management division. The stock kept falling anyway. Now, the only real option for Lehman's management is to put the entire company up for sale.
Oh, this sounds like a company I want to buy. Where do I line up?
Well, if you want to buy shares of Lehman Brothers, I'm sure there are a lot of people who will sell them to you right
now. Well,
who
does want to buy this thing?
Well, there aren't a lot of companies that are able or willing to invest, I think mainly because Lehman's financial system is still quite murky. The Korean Development Bank, which is a state-run institution, was thinking about investing in Lehman. It pulled out. Goldman Sachs was supposed to be thinking about a deal, but then it came out and said, no, not us. There have been published reports that the most likely buyer is Bank of America, maybe Barclays Bank. But I talked to someone who's familiar with the talks yesterday who said basically a lot of options are still on the table.
So if there's a lot of uncertainty, does any buyer pay pennies on the dollar, and do the current stockholders get wiped out?
Well, it depends on what options that, you know, are finally chosen, of course. At the worst, Lehman Brothers could end up like Bear Stearns, subsumed into another big company. The shareholders have also already lost a lot of money. The shares of Lehman are down more than 90% in a year. In the case of Bear Stearns, you know, shareholders ended up getting very little money, and that could certainly happen again.
Well, you mentioned Bear Stearns. Is the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, are they getting involved in the way that they got involved with Bear Stearns, moving in with loan guarantees and other efforts to make this a more attractive deal for somebody?
Right. Well, in the case of Bear Stearns, the federal government really engineered the deal and guaranteed some of Bear's debt as a way to induce J.P. Morgan Chase to buy the company. The source I talked to says, you know, this time the federal government is assisting. It's monitoring the talks. It isn't expected to put any federal money into the pot, partly because that since the Bear Stearns deal, there are now other ways for investment banks like Lehman to get money. They can borrow from the Federal Reserve's discount lending window. So the federal government itself doesn't have to play the same direct role it played before, and it won't.
Jim, in just a couple of seconds, does anybody you talk to think that Lehman Brothers is going to be the last firm to get in this much trouble over the mortgage mess?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think that there are just ongoing questions about all financial companies right now. It seems like one gets taken care of, and then we move on to address problems someplace else in the market. I mean, it's like wildfires.
Hmm. Jim, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Jim Zeroli covers business from New York.
During economic downturns, conventional wisdom has it that hemlines drop and colors darken. In New York, fashion editors, store buyers, and fashionistas have been finding out what the spring fashions will bring. Among those who've been in the thick of Fashion Week is Simon Doonan. He's the creative director of Barney's New York. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you. So you've just been living, I think, at Fashion Week all this week. Break it to us. Are hemlines up or down?
Well, I'm always very amused by that idea that fashion might have these overarching messages, because fashion is sort of this very incoherent place. I mean, I can give you examples. Like in the 60s, short skirts were seen as a sign of a new era of optimism and economic stability, but they were closely followed by very long skirts. So fashion is sort of wonderfully nonsensical and has its own evolution.
Do you think that fashion does respond to the economy, says something about the economy?
I think the buyers respond to the economy. So, for example, I've heard groups of buyers this week saying they're playing it safe, they're going to buy, you know, basics, they're going to buy things that women really need. They're not going to necessarily go for the spangled unitard. They're probably going to invest in items which are less challenging to the consumer and therefore more likely to sell.
What do you mean when you say buyers are buying basics?
Well, you're not actually going to see basics at Fashion Week. Basics is something that the buyer confronts when they go to the showroom. I was at Michael Kors. There was a beautiful jacket that had a big hand-painted stripe all the way around it. And you know when you go to the showroom, you can buy that jacket without the big hand-painted stripe on it, and you're probably going to sell more of the one without the stripe.
What does influence what we end up wearing?
I think there are trends, and what drives them and what drives what people wear is more about change. For example, last spring, the big story from all the runways was color. Color and print, color and print. And then this fall, it's been all about black. And people have said, oh, is this because of the economy and there's this new restraint and blah, blah, blah. But in my opinion, it's more about just a pendulum kind of action between thick and thin, high and low, which is driven by the design process rather than by designers having any sense of the zeitgeist. Because I think designers also look to distinguish themselves from one another. They don't have like a big kind of Dr. Strangelove conclave where they all get together and say, hey, let's do more modest hems because the economy's in the toilet or whatever. They're making their own little zeitgeist in their own little cocoon.
Simon Doonan, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Have me back soon.
Simon Doonan writes the style column in the New York Observer, and he's author of the new book, Eccentric Glamour.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Well, now that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are under government control, Democrats in Congress are urging them to suspend foreclosures for at least 90 days. Members of the Senate Banking Committee asked the companies to do more to help keep people in their homes. Fannie and Freddie back nearly half the outstanding mortgages in the U.S.
This drama has been going on for months. The events that brought about last weekend's government takeover began in earnest in March. NPR's John Idsty walks us through what's happened since then.
The irony is that just 6 months ago, despite concerns about their future, Fannie and Freddie were declared sound by their regulator, James Lockhart. On March 19th in New York City, he told Wall Street the two were ready to rescue the U.S. mortgage market.
I think the actions we're taking today and the prudence that they have displayed over the last year makes bailout talk nonsense. These companies are safe and sound, and we're going to ensure by our everyday oversight that they continue to be safe and sound.
But investors weren't buying it. As the U.S. housing market continued its collapse, questions were swirling about the health of the two firms that hold or guarantee more than $5 trillion in mortgages. And by mid-July, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was before Congress, urging them to give him virtually unlimited authority to spend taxpayer money to keep them afloat. He needed the power, he said, but he didn't think he'd have to use it.
If you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you've got a bazooka and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out. It will increase confidence, and by increasing confidence, it will greatly reduce the likelihood it will ever be used.
With broad powers, Paulson hoped to calm investors and give Fannie and Freddie time to raise new capital, a cushion against big losses that were sure to come as many mortgages they held and guaranteed went bad. Congress gave Paulson his bazooka on July 26th. Within a week of getting it, he hired the Wall Street firm Morgan Stanley to help him figure out if he really would have to use it. In the next couple of weeks, about three dozen Morgan Stanley bankers, along with federal regulators from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, pored over the mortgage giant's books and found them much worse off than expected. Meanwhile, investor confidence continued to deteriorate, including among foreign governments whose central banks hold huge amounts of Fannie and Freddie bonds. Bonds bought with the belief that, in a pinch, the U.S. government would back them. On August 19th, market analyst James Rosner was skeptical about the future of the firms.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you can say you have to dump it if you own it at this point. Do I think there's a good chance that the equity ends up wiped out? Yeah, I do.
Bond investors were telling Morgan Stanley bankers that the government needed to inject capital to boost confidence. But when asked how much, it soon became clear only a massive infusion could hope to calm the markets. According to NPR sources present at many of the meetings, Paulson decided that it wasn't in the cards because it would involve injecting taxpayer money with no real control of the companies. There were two other options being considered: a conservatorship similar to Chapter 11 bankruptcy, from which companies can emerge, or receivership, a total takeover of the company. On August 26th, Paulson went to the White House Situation Room. He was connected by video conference with President Bush at his ranch in Crawford. He described how a conservatorship might work. Deputy Press Secretary Tony Fratto.
The president certainly agreed during that teleconference that Secretary Paulson had the right plan.
The final shape of the takeover came after a grueling series of meetings over the Labor Day weekend. Those assembled agreed that putting Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship was the right move. It gave the government at least temporary control of the companies and time for the new Congress and administration to decide on their long-term future. Paulson met with the leaders of Fannie and Freddie the following Friday to tell them they would be taken over. Reports suggest both Daniel Mudd of Fannie Mae and Richard Syron of Freddie Mac were surprised. They were told to tell their boards a takeover was inevitable, with or without their approval. Then, on Sunday morning, when world markets were closed, Paulson made the announcement. He said a takeover was necessary to protect the world's financial system.
A failure would affect the ability of Americans to get home loans, auto loans, and other consumer credit and business finance. And a failure would be harmful to economic growth and job creation. That is why we have taken these actions today.
Paulson said, among other things, the Treasury would provide credit lines worth $100 billion for each company. With money like that on the line, this takeover could become the biggest bailout in U.S. history. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
A few weeks ago, when there was still some guarded optimism about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Kenneth Rogoff made a speech in Singapore. The Harvard economist, formerly chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, said the U.S. is not out of the woods. The financial crisis is at the halfway point, perhaps. The worst is yet to come. And that, he said, would likely include one of the big banks or investment banks going under. Markets, as they say, tumbled on his remarks. Well, Professor Rogoff joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And first, is Lehman Brothers, say, the very big investment bank you had in mind? And if we were perhaps midway through the crisis a month ago, are we up to maybe 60% through it by now?
Well, I don't think I had any one in mind. There certainly the industry is bloated and consolidation was ahead. And I think that we're going to see something like that, yes.
When you say it's bloated and consolidation was ahead, in this case, consolidation means what exactly?
Well, I mean, first let me say what I mean by bloated. I mean, here's an industry which was just reaping in epic profits, more than the tech sector, more than biotech. And just like any industry that goes through a boom, it's not unusual to need to see some pruning. In the airline industry, we still have tens of millions of people flying, but periodically a big airline goes out of business. And that's what will happen with the financial industry, that these profits just couldn't continue. And it's going to get somewhat smaller. Now, that can happen because everybody shrinks 20%, what you might call an immaculate contraction of the industry. But that's not the way capitalist systems work. Big businesses go out of business. That's more typical. The strong survive and the weak fail.
Now, I realize that there are lots and lots of properties with mortgages on them. But as a layman, I find this very puzzling. It would seem to me that by now, the banks and the regulators would have at least plumbed the depths of that crisis and come up with a good sense of who's exposed to how much risk of delinquency or default. Have they not done that? And if not, why not? Why does that crisis seem to grow?
Well, the point is, it's not just a matter of some bad debts. if that were all it were, you could recapitalize the system, so to speak, give them fresh infusions of cash, and they'd be off to the races again. But the problem is the subprime crisis has exposed weaknesses in a lot of the investment banks and some of the bank's most profitable lines of business, and these very complicated rocket science, so-called derivatives, these trades that nobody understands except a few people. And this has been incredibly profitable, and it's gone. And just putting in some capital is not going to bring all this business back. And that's part of the problem.
That the business was simply overgrown. It assumed more financial sector activity than our economy actually can sustain.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise investors would be jumping in. They just think these were fantastic buys, but they're nervous that the whole model, isn't going to be quite what it was, and having some consolidation is going to leave more room for the remaining firms to make profit. So I don't think we want to get hysterical about this, but this is what we mean by consolidation. It is indeed a euphemism for some firms failing.
Yeah, if the problem is a bloated financial sector and the solution is consolidation, then the failure of banks or investment banks are signs that the situation is actually playing out and healing and correcting itself. So we should expect there to be, by that analysis, we should expect failures if things are actually happening according to schedule.
So that's the silver lining. That's the good side of it. The difficult side of it is the financial system's so complicated that we don't quite know if Lehman, were to default, what happens to General Motors? They're very dependent on their lending. What happens to, some of the other big investment banks like Merrill Lynch? We don't know. On the one hand, you want consolidation. You want to let an airline go out of business. You don't want all the airlines to go out of business. But this is a very delicate moment. I don't want to pretend this is easy. I'm putting an optimistic spin on what is the worst financial crisis since World War II.
Ken Rogoff, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That's Professor Kenneth Rogoff, economist at Harvard University, used to be chief economist at the International Monetary Fund.